More than 600,000 people each year in North America alone sustain cardiac arrest.
We know that 50% plus of ROS cases will require vasopressors.
I do tend to increase my MAP target to at least 70.
Welcome everyone to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. This is Mike Winters from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore. And as always on our podcast, we are so thankful, so grateful, so appreciative that you are joining us for yet another podcast. And we are going to talk about a topic that may seem familiar, but in reality, looking back, we haven't talked about it for at least 2 years. And that's going to be the management of patients with ROSC in the emergency department. It's based on a really great recent article published in the American Journal of Emergency Medicine by two friends of ours, Britt Long and Mike Gottlieb. They did an outstanding job, a super comprehensive review on what's the latest evidence recommendations in caring for the post-arrest patient that we achieve return of spontaneous circulation in. We'll hit those key highlights. Where are we at with respect to key management questions? And to that end, I'm super excited, just like we did with the last podcast, to bring in my co-host here on CCPEM, Dr. Peter W., Dr. John Greenwood, and Dr. Rob Rodriguez, that really add wonderful perspective on all of these issues that we're going to touch on today. So let me turn it over to them for just an intro. Peter, how are things going on this recording?
So going just fine, just fine. We're eagerly awaiting fall in New Orleans. 80 degrees today with the cool front approaching. So we're looking forward to that. But other than that, everything's doing well.
Outstanding. How are things with you, Dr. Greenwood?
Everything's great. I had a really good weekend. It was actually in New York City. And New York City in the fall is just beautiful, as always. I was presenting at the NYU Langone Critical Care Cardiology Symposium. And that's run by Jim Horowitz, who's a close friend of mine. And I've known Jim for a while through Penn, and now he's a CICU director up there at NYU. They hold an annual conference for cardiac critical care related issues. And interestingly enough, while the audience was primarily cardiologists, emergency medicine was highly represented. Ben Abella presented up there. Sarah Perman, who's up in Yale, presented on post-cardiac arrest care. And I got to speak on some resuscitation and some research microcirculation topics. So it was a lot of fun, great time. Highly recommended conference if that's an area of your interest.
Outstanding. Well, would highly recommend that too. And congrats, John, for speaking. You mentioned NYU Langone. That I heard that earlier in our hospital conversations, and that centered around their efforts around patient safety and some lessons learned that we are looking at for a variety of things at our medical center in Maryland. So sounds like a lot of great stuff going on at NYU Langone. And Dr. Rodriguez, how does this podcast find you?
Doing great. November, I would say the prettiest times of year out here in California. And I'm looking forward to going to the East Coast to visit my kids, as well as a trip down to Texas for the AAMC annual meeting. So things are going great.
Outstanding. And I suspect that many of you will be listening to this after Halloween in the U.S. and approaching another big holiday in the United States, and that's Thanksgiving. So we certainly hope that many of you have some upcoming plans for a wonderful holiday season. All right, so let's get to the podcast topic at hand. That is managing the patient with post-arrest or return of spontaneous circulation after presenting with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. And I think you all know the stats very well. More than 600,000 people each year in North America alone sustain cardiac arrest. Many are brought to our emergency departments for resuscitation. We know from a background standpoint that about three quarters of these patients, the etiology is something cardiac related, versus about 15 to 25% or some non-cardiac etiology. Having said that, we work very hard delivering high quality CPR, early defibrillation for shockable rhythms, getting patients back. Once we achieve return to spontaneous circulation, as you've heard us say on the podcast before, now the work really begins to really optimize that patient's care in the post-arrest setting to give them the best chance of getting out of the hospital with meaningful neurologic survival. We know the stats are relatively unchanged. Of all those patients coming in with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, unfortunately, only about 10% survive to hospital discharge. And that's what we want to touch on during this particular podcast, is what are some key things that we can focus on and some tangible things that we can do at the bedside in the management of these patients to give them the best chance of getting out of the hospital with good neurologic survival. Now, with respect to our colleagues, Dr. Long, Dr. Gottlieb, in their article, they spend the first portion of that going over the post-cardiac arrest syndrome. I think it's pretty insightful to go over that. We're not going to really touch on that during the podcast. We are going to focus on what are those secondary management things that we need to consider in the emergency department in this setting. Certainly, when we get someone back in the post-ROSC period, what are we focusing on? Well, it's supporting their cardiopulmonary functioning, addressing and to trying to determine if we can discover the etiology of their arrest, and then minimizing secondary cerebral injury and then correcting any physiologic derangements. So let's get started with some key questions here. And I'm going to once again turn this back to Peter, John, and Rob in terms of these secondary management priorities. Let me focus on limiting secondary cerebral injury. And to that end, there's a lot of discussion on, we'll get to targeted temperature management or more so temperature control, but let's talk about sedation in the post-arrest patient. Let's talk about monitoring for seizure activity, and let's talk about actually assessing patients for elevated ICP. But with respect to sedation in the post-arrest patient, I want to get your thoughts on practice with respect to limiting cerebral injury as it pertains to the potential for elevations in ICP. Peter, let me start with you and get your thoughts on sedation and analgesia.
Right. And so yes, lead with that the patient deserves sedation and analgesia. I'll probably start with a little bit of fentanyl and then monitor the blood pressure very carefully. If the blood pressure looks robust, then I'll typically go with propofol because I'll get a two for one. I'll get sedation and then seizure suppression. And I like that. If the blood pressure is really wimpy and I'm struggling and maybe reaching for a vasopressor, then I'll probably use either Precedex or ketamine, depending on how challenging the blood pressure management is.
Outstanding. John, thoughts on sedation and analgesia to get started?
So I think the standard answer is probably going to be analgo sedation, right? So assume that the patient's having some element of pain. So something like a low-dose fentanyl infusion is reasonable. And then kind of determine from there whether or not the patient's showing signs, objective signs, with some sort of pain grimacing scale or an agitation sedation scale of needing sedation. Now, we will talk about this a little bit more in terms of early on, but many of these patients will go on to receive targeted temperature management. And so it's my opinion that during this period, we should upfront provide some degree of analgo sedation. Now, I will say this isn't necessarily common practice across the board. Even within our own medical system at the University of Pennsylvania, there are clinicians who will withhold analgesia and sedation if the patient isn't showing any signs of discomfort in anticipation of trying to get a neurologic exam in some degree of time. Now, the evidence for this practice isn't, I'm not aware of evidence of this practice. It is a cultural thing, but I do know that it does exist. So I lean on the side of practicing analgo sedation first. And, certainly it's patient specific. So if the patient does have, as Peter said, hemodynamic instability, I might beware of the dose of propofol that I might administer or some other sedative. But I do administer some form of pain control and sedation. I'm not worried about the neurologic exam early on in this acute phase of post-cardiac arrest care.
Outstanding comments, Peter and John. Let me wrap that up. Go to Rob for his thoughts on analgesia and sedation as we lead into this more comprehensive discussion on post-arrest management.
Yeah, I agree with the choices of fentanyl and propofol, but I am in that camp of I don't immediately sedate these patients post-ROSC if they're not intubated, and I don't think that they need to be intubated. I give them a minute or two to see if they're going to wake up, and even if they got intubated, I'll wait a few minutes to see if they start reaching for the tube or having full arousal. And there have been more than a few times in which I've had ROSC patients who wake up and don't have to continue with intubation. So I'm in that camp of not immediately sedating these patients. But when I do, I do use fentanyl and propofol.
All right. Well, let me stay in this preventing secondary cerebral injury. And we've talked before on different podcasts on the post-arrest patient to think about seizure activity, especially in comatose patients. The data would suggest that at least for myoclonic or seizure-like activity, this may occur in almost half of our patients. And especially those who remain comatose, recommendations are to consider or really think about EEG monitoring, because if patients have ongoing seizures, that is going to worsen neurologic injury, potentially worsen overall morbidity and mortality. And we know that many of our listeners practice in a variety of different practice settings, but to the extent possible, getting an EEG as early as possible to detect seizure activity is recommended. And we also know that the current evidence wouldn't support just widespread giving every post-arrest patient an anti-seizure or anti-epileptic medication, only really in those that demonstrate seizure activity if you're capable of getting an EEG. Now, another component of the paper that Dr. Long and Dr. Gottlieb wrote was about actually not only looking for seizures, but screening for elevations in ICP. And so, recommending getting neuroimaging with your non-contrast head CT. Does it show cerebral edema? Looking on your physical exam, is there pupillary asymmetry or the potential for a focal abnormality? And then the other component that they recommend is really considering as we continue to advance in our ultrasound skills within emergency medicine and critical care, measuring the optic nerve sheath diameter to see if it demonstrates signs of elevations in ICP. And if so, cerebral edema on CT, maybe pupillary asymmetry, enlarged optic nerve sheath diameter, think about elevating the head of the bed, more aggressive analgo sedation, think about hypertonic saline, and then maybe even driving your MAP goals, which we'll get to shortly, a little bit higher. So I wanted to circle back with you, John. I'm going to start with you on this question. Are you thinking about this elevation in ICP, thinking about these things in the management and say the ED management of your post-arrest patient?
So I think that neurologic outcome is probably the most important thing that we have to try to achieve in these patients. A life or saving is one that includes getting back to hopefully interacting, engaging with family, and doing some of the things that they were able to do prior to this tragic event. So I think I'm thinking a lot about neurologic conditions, ICP, and specifically seizures. I think that the data is somewhere around almost 50% of patients will experience some degree of seizure-like activity if it's not an actual seizure. So that includes myoclonic jerking, generalized shaking. If I'm seeing eye deviation, I'm treating that with benzodiazepines and definitely going to keep a very close eye that seizure activity is alleviated by my benzodiazepines. But there is some interesting data that I thought the authors here pointed out, and that's the question of should we be providing routine or prophylactic anti-epileptic medications? And I believe in some practices that's standard for them, but in mine it is not. And it doesn't appear that it's routinely recommended. The TELSTAR trial published in 2022 looked at neurologic outcome in patients who received empiric or prophylactic anti-epileptic drugs, even if they didn't have signs of seizure, and it did not improve or change the neurologic outcome. But if there is any concern, if there's evidence of myoclonus or jerking, I am getting that EEG right away.
Outstanding. Let me now go over to Rob, thinking about ultrasound here. Are you routinely incorporating optic nerve sheath diameter measurements or thinking about further investigation for cerebral edema?
A really good question. I treat everybody the same. In other words, I'm always having that head of a bed elevated to at least, to about 30 degrees. So I'm assuming that they have elevated ICP. And so done a little bit of optic sheath diameter measurements. I don't, to be honest, I don't have enough experience with it to recommend it or recommend against it. Whether I'm getting a routine head CTs, any patient that's post cardiac arrest that does not wake up, I am getting a head CT as part of their workup. And whether I continue to get serial CTs really kind of just depends. So my practice is again to treat as everybody as if they're going to have some elevation in their ICP. And to get a routine head CTs on people that don't wake up.
All right, over to Peter. Wrap us up on this discussion.
Yeah, so I'm a stickler for looking at the hands, looking at the feet, looking at the mouth, and looking at the eyes for non-convulsive status, right? Is there some nystagmus that's going on? Is there eye deviation? Is there bruxism? Is there lip smacking? Are they chewing the ET tube? Is there some twitch to the finger pill rolling? Are they twitching their feet? Anything like that? As John mentioned, I'm going to dose with benzos and then have a heightened suspicion for non-convulsive status and press for the EEG in those patients. You already heard Rob talk to you about elevation head of the bed, but we're going to do that not just for the head, but also to decrease aspiration and pneumonia risk. So that's my only additions to what's already been said.
All right, outstanding comments. Well, we are going to get to a quick map review, oxygenation, ventilation, and come circle back on temperature control. But Rob, you mentioned getting CTs. Let's stay on that for a moment and talk about the role of CT in your management of post-arrest patients. We've touched on some articles in recent years here on the podcast that has looked at the utility of pan CT in a post-arrest patient, so a non-con head CT, a CTA or CT coronary of the chest, and then a CT of the abdomen and pelvis with IV contrast or runoff to detect the etiology of cardiac arrest and then possibly look for complications of the resuscitation itself. And in those particular studies, it did demonstrate that in a pretty good percentage, pan CT picked up an etiology, but perhaps more importantly, it detected a large percentage of complications of the resus itself that may have changed management. Now, to be clear, those studies didn't portend a mortality change, but it raises the discussion point of just utilizing CT in our post-arrest patients. So, Rob, now I'm going to start with you on this. You brought it up. Do you utilize, say, a pan CT or whole body CT in the post-arrest patient looking for the etiology and then potentially complications?
Yeah, I would like to say that I'm a purist who doesn't, immediately like jump on the bandwagon about im broad imaging. And I was that way, I would say, for a few years up until maybe a year or two ago. I didn't used to get head to pelvis CT on patients routinely. Now I have found findings that alter management, and so I've become a convert. Again, I grew up very much in the Jerry Hoffman mindset of not doing testing unless it truly changes outcomes. But there's just a lot of information that you get from it. So I do incorporate that into my practice.
Well said. Peter, your thoughts?
Yeah, so I kind of presented this nationally, the initial research studies for both sepsis as well as ROSC, and saying when there's not a clear etiology, does the patient benefit from pan scan? And it benefits for making an additional diagnosis, but it doesn't really change the outcome. And so I kind of presented both sides of that. So I'm somewhat ambivalent. My practice is to get it if there's not a clear etiology, EKGs with tomb stoning, some electrolyte abnormality, end-stage renal disease that looks like it ticked off VTAC or torsades or something like that, I won't get it. But if we're scratching our heads and saying we don't know what's going on here, I will get one.
Outstanding. All right, John, your thoughts?
Yeah, so we've moved towards largely the pan scan approach on most of our post-cardiac arrest patients. Part of that is that we have locally even identified a large number of problems that required intervention. I think our intervention rate was somewhere around like 20% of things that needed to be addressed post-arrest. So one out of four, one out of five patients, it changed management. And while it didn't have a mortality benefit by the literature, it does have a intermediate benefit in our eyes of incremental change that could potentially lead to an outcome difference. Although understanding the likelihood of survival in this entire patient population is really low. But we certainly get a head CT, chest CT, and abdominal CT. I think in terms of the literature that's been quoted, 80% of patients will have some positive findings. So it's a pretty high rate. I'm not as sold on the likelihood of finding the cause on CT, but I do think it provides helpful data, especially in the patient who you don't know why they had an arrest. If it was a primary VF arrest and they got CPR, then I'm just looking for rib fractures, hematoma, liver injury, spleen injury from really good high quality CPR, as long as they're compressing in the right position. But we have had primary liver injuries and spleen injuries from our Lucas device having low placement. So, the device is no joke. That plunger's pushing down, if it's malpositioned, can cause a lot of trouble, in addition to good high quality compressions if it's used properly.
All right, outstanding discussion thus far, gentlemen. We've hit on a few key things that the article highlights in your practice in minimizing secondary cerebral injury. Let's move on to just the bigger concept of supporting cardiopulmonary function. So let's dive into MAP, O2, CO2 concentrations that we've hit separately in podcasts over the years. So, in terms of recommended mean arterial pressure targets, and what are our first line or go-to vasopressor agents? I think Britt and Mike do a nice job summarizing the evidence and articles we've touched on, but in essence, they report that really based on what's available at this time in comatose patients following ROSC from cardiac arrest, really recommending a MAP goal of at least 65, but preferably greater than 80 to ensure that we have an adequate cerebral perfusion pressure if we don't have the ability to routinely monitor cerebral perfusion along with the calculate the CPP. So at least 65, recommending greater than 80, recommending norepinephrine as a first-line vasopressor agent, and then possibly considering the utilization of inotropic therapy. So I'm Peter, now I'm going back to you to start this conversation on mean arterial pressure. Your thoughts on those recommended goals and what you're doing in clinical practice.
So thanks, Mike. And so I love their recommendation. And again, we have to first say that the evidence in this area is weak, right? But having said that, the evidence that exists points towards higher MAPs. There's two real conditions that call for MAPS greater than 65, and ROSC is one of them. The other is spinal shock. And so when I teach on this subject, I talk about 75 plus as a mean arterial blood pressure goal for both of those conditions. But particularly in this condition with ROSC, understanding that if it is in fact a heart disease etiology, the bulk of those patients have chronic hypertension. And so oftentimes their perfusion curves are shifted to the right and require a higher mean arterial blood pressure to reach their goals. But again, I want to point to the evidence, and there's no strong evidence that points to survival benefit of driving it here, right? I agree strongly that it's Levofed as our drug, and you should have your dobutamine ready, and you should be assessing with echo and ultrasound our LV function as well as RV function for our patients.
Peter, those are outstanding comments. Let me actually just have you add one more point that we were talking about prior to the actual recording. And you were talking about the number of post-arrest patients with hemodynamic lability likely to need pressors and really being prepared.
So thank you. So in our shop, if we get EMS call that we have ROSC coming in, then we ask for Levofed and dobutamine at the bedside. We don't want to have a delay in institution of pressors and to tolerate abject hypotension, understanding brain injury as well as cardiac injury in those cases. We know that 50% plus of ROSC cases will require vasopressors. So getting them ready and ready to roll is important. It's a $10 investment for each bag, so it's not costly medicine.
Great, great points. John, turning to you next.
So it's a great question. And as everyone knows who has listened to us over the years, I'm much more of a flow person as opposed to a pressure person. What's the blood flow? Is it adequate? Is that mean arterial pressure providing adequate blood flow? And we need to think about every vital organ here. And unfortunately, all of them have their own autoregulation and it's all messed up in each of them, the kidneys, the brain, liver, the heart. And it's really difficult to know if you're achieving adequate blood flow at any given MAP. And so I do tend to increase my MAP target to at least 70, especially when I see a head CT that has some element of cerebral edema. I think that that's important to maintain cerebral perfusion pressure. I don't have a MAP goal greater than 80, though. I don't think there's a whole lot of evidence for that. The paper that's cited in this review article is actually quite interesting. It's one I read a little while ago, but I went and looked back at it. After seeing the citation, it's a Canadian interventional trial of a small number of patients, about 10 to 20 patients by Mypinder Sekhon. It was published in Critical Care Medicine back in 2019, where they looked at tissue oxygenation, brain tissue oxygenation, at different MAP goals and found that at higher MAP goals, they achieved better brain perfusion. Now, unfortunately, most of us don't have invasive ICP monitors in our patients, and we don't know. And so we have to be pretty empiric and about what our MAP targets are going to be. So there is a little physiologic data that supports higher MAP goals in most of the trials with invasive ICP monitoring. Higher MAPs improve brain perfusion. So I do tend to err on the side of a higher MAP target.
All right, Rob, two outstanding perspectives and great pearls from Peter and John. What are your thoughts on MAP?
Yeah, I'm more in alignment with what John was saying. I definitely shoot for a MAP of at least 65 or 70, but I don't try to go past that. I think that trial was pretty well done, and it's a high level of evidence that it doesn't improve outcomes. And so I really don't target a super high MAP in these people. And I agree that norepinephrine is my first line drug, but I also pay a lot of attention to heart rate in these patients. And so if I have a patient who has a very low heart, let's say in the 60 or below range, I might switch to epinephrine in those patients because it's going to give chronotropy. So I pay attention to both heart rate and blood pressure in these patients as I do in all sort of resuscitation patients.
All right, love the various perspectives. Let's pivot now from supporting cardiac function, circulatory function, to pulmonary function. Let's just touch on ventilation and oxygenation for a moment. And in essence, this portion summarizing the available literature, basically recommending using a lung protective ventilatory strategy with tidal volumes ranging anywhere from 4 to 8 milliliters per kilogram of ideal body weight, avoiding hypoxia and targeting saturations between 92 to 98%, not 100%, but titrating O2 to 92 to 98% saturation, and then utilizing CO2, could be done with end-tidal CO2, but if you're measuring arterial CO2, keeping that level somewhere between 35 to 55, likely being beneficial while also taking into context what the patient's pH is with respect to hypercapnia. So, with those recommendations, John, you're up first for thoughts on ventilation and oxygenation.
Yep. So ARDS and severe pulmonary injury is actually quite common. At least half of patients after cardiac arrest will develop some degree of low-level ARDS. So we have to be really careful here in what we're prescribing in terms of mechanical ventilation. So I start with low tidal volume ventilation with a titrated PEEP. And I do follow that greater than 92% goal that follows the EXACT trial published in 2022. And in addition to that normocapnia, although, with low tidal volume ventilation, oftentimes you can tolerate some degree of mild respiratory acidosis as long as my pH is greater than 7.2. I'm generally okay with that, but certainly avoiding hyperventilation to prevent any cerebral vasoconstriction. Remember, what we do in people who have really bad head bleeds as a salvage measure is hyperventilate them to try to help reduce cerebral blood flow. So allowing patients to breathe or be really tachypneic or to get that PCO2 down low can actually could be harmful. And so the TAME trial was the one that showed us that normocapnia is ideally the goal we have right now.
Outstanding. Rob, you're second here. Ventilation, oxygenation.
I don't have much to add. I targeted an O2 sat between 92 and 95. I try to avoid above 95. And the only thing that I would add is I'm very attentive to the FiO2 immediately upon ROSC. In other words, during resuscitation, we are using 100% FiO2, and sometimes that setting gets left there. So I make it a point to immediately look at the vent settings and dial it down upon ROSC. That's to prevent oxygen radical development. But other than that, I don't really have much to add.
All right, Peter, wrap this
Yeah, just
section up for us.
right. Just one thing to add. A lot of our patients that have elevated BMI, we need to have their old gases or old chemistries so that we can predict where the PCO2 needs to be, as opposed to, as John mentioned earlier, being relatively hypocapnic or absolutely hypocapnic for our patients can be very injurious. And since we're seeing more and more patients with elevated BMI and obstructive sleep apnea and obesity hypoventilation syndromes, just try to look at those chemistries in the past and apply some Winner's formula to that to predict where our PCO2 should be.
Sounds outstanding. Well, we're starting to come towards the home stretch here in this podcast. Let me just summarize a few other key questions, but I do want to hit some others with the three of you. The question has come up over the years, do we give antibiotics to our post-arrest patient, and that's based on the increased risk that patients may have aspiration, they may develop pneumonia, they may develop ventilator-associated pneumonia, they could have bacteremia from translocation due to overall just a hypoperfused state during the cardiac arrest. Well, at the moment, based on available data, really the recommendations are to not routinely administer antibiotics to all of our post-arrest patients. Similarly, in the post-cardiac arrest syndrome, there is this significant inflammatory or systemic inflammatory response. So corticosteroids have been looked at in the post-arrest patient. Can it reduce that severity of systemic inflammation and ultimately improve outcomes? And similar to the antibiotic conversation, at present with the current evidence, routine corticosteroids are not recommended in all comers with return of out of hospital cardiac arrest patients with return of spontaneous circulation, with the exception if you know someone already has adrenal insufficiency or perhaps decompensated hypothyroidism. Lastly, with respect to this, before we touch on temperature control, is the concept or the question of who should go to cath, that post-cardiac arrest patient who may have a STEMI and may need to get directly to cath. And really, recommendations are get an EKG as soon as possible after ROSC. If it looks like it's concerning for an acute coronary occlusion, initiate your cardiac consultation for cath lab activation. Having said that, based on a study we reviewed a few years ago, if it's really within those first 7 minutes, the sensitivity of that initial EKG is a little bit lower. So repeat it. Still recommending activation of your cath lab team, but repeat it after about 10 minutes. Make sure those ST segment changes are either persistent or potentially worsening. But in the absence of that, routine cardiac catheterization, emergent cardiac catheterization in patients who don't have have evidence of ST elevation on their post-arrest EKG have not been shown to have beneficial outcomes when compared to those that go to catheterization at some point during their hospitalization. And those key articles we've reviewed here, the COAC trial, the Tomahawk trial, the EMERGE trial with respect to post-cardiac arrest cath. Now, turning back to temperature control. So a huge area that we've talked about really over our lifespan here on CCPM really got started in the early 2000s. What are we doing with temperature control? And John, I'm going to start with you here, put you on the spot and say, what should we do at the bedside regarding temperature control?
It's a debate. I'm still a 33 degrees guy for 24 hours, and I get it that TTM1, TTM2 didn't show any necessarily clinical outcomes benefit, didn't show harm. I think there's physiologic data that still supports the temperature of 33 degrees. And I can tell you, I don't have many complications associated with targeting that temperature. I do worry significantly about fever. I think that's a major issue. And if I can stay as far away as possible from fever, I try to do that. So I myself and, a good cohort of clinicians at my institution still target 33 degrees, although there are many that have moved to the 36 degrees for the first 24 hours. And then at least active control normothermia for another 48 hours for a total of 72 hours. And then we can start thinking about other things like neurologic exam. So I still am a 33 degree practitioner.
All right, debate continues. Let me see what Dr. W says.
So I'm not a 33 guy, but I am a 36 guy. And I'm hard behind the 36 just for my practice. And that has to do, again, with what John is saying, looking at this 72 hours. So if you survived ROSC, made it to the ED, and then survived your time in the ED and made it up to the ICU, again, 50 to 60% of those people survive, and a relatively large percentage of those people survive with meaningful neurological outcome. So anything I can do to limit secondary injury, I'm going to do that. And so temperature is one of those things.
All right. Love the comments, Dr. Rodriguez. Your thoughts on temperature control?
This is largely driven by where you're practicing, and different institutions have their set guidelines. And so I go with what my current institution does. So I don't really have hard feelings either way. We go currently with the 33 to 34 degrees. Again, I think that the evidence is conflicting in terms of lower targets and versus maintaining normothermia or preventing fever. There's a lot. We've been over this in past episodes. There's a lot of evidence that at institutions that switch back from hypothermia to normothermia, they found worse outcomes. And so if it were up to me, I would target 32 to 34.
All right. Outstanding comments. This has been such a helpful discussion, gentlemen, in terms of just comprehensive care of the post-arrest patient. Before wrapping up, closing things out, let me ask Peter, any final thoughts, any areas perhaps that they did an outstanding job in this article? Any additional areas that perhaps they didn't touch on that are important here?
Yeah, the one thing that I feel very strongly about and championing for my patient population is the consideration of Narcan. We know that 15 to 25% of our ROS cases are non-cardiac in nature. So if someone's failing to wake up early on, give them a boatload of Narcan, right? And just do that as a trial. You might be surprised at what you find. The synthetic stuff that we're getting now is not just powerful, but it's long acting. And so give, a hefty dose of Narcan and see where that gets you.
Yeah, I agree with that. John, any final thoughts, things that we may not have covered that you want to highlight?
Yeah, I do. I think that while we are focusing largely on the post-arrest care and the survivors, I want to encourage everyone out there, engage with your EMS colleagues as much as possible on this patient population. They probably have one of the biggest, if not the biggest, opportunity to get a patient to you as a physician than anyone else, other than their neighbor that may have actually witnessed that cardiac arrest and provided bystander CPR. There's a ton of nihilism out there about likelihood of outcomes, or should we just terminate resuscitation efforts because 9 out of 10 of my patients don't even survive? So, why are we even doing this? They need to hear about the success stories, the patients that they've saved. They don't get that feedback often. The one thing I'll point out, and this has been tried and true over the past couple of decades, the Kings County EMS group out in Seattle, their return of spontaneous circulation rate, getting patients to survive and get to the hospital, has been consistently over 50%. And I can tell you, compared to Philadelphia, that's probably about 5 times what we get. And their neurologic outcomes are probably close to 20% compared to Philadelphia, where it's 7%. They're doing it right out there. And you know why? Because they practice, they care, they're encouraged. So if you have the opportunity to interact with your EMS colleagues, that's probably one of the most important things you can do, and then focus on all the things we talked about in this podcast.
Yeah, really, really well said, John. Thank you for bringing that up. Rob, you get the last word in closing this podcast out. Final thoughts?
Yeah, I love those two points that John and Peter made, especially talking to your EMS colleagues. I have seen a lot of nihilism out in my radio calls And there's the added point also, and this might sound a bit callous, but sometimes getting people back, and even if you don't get neurological recovery, some of those people can go on to be organ donors as they had planned to do. And that sort of segues into my final recommendation is, we've talked a lot about treating the patient and focusing on the patient. We also got to consider the families in this situation and early discussions with them about what happened during their resuscitation, and letting them know what to expect over the next 24 hours. That's a big part of our job as well. So I would add family care discussions to my checklist of post-ROSC interventions and measures.
Well, I want to, as always, I want to thank the three of you. Really outstanding perspectives. I think this is such a helpful podcast on just management of our post-arrest patients as we worked hard to achieve ROSC. Now, what are those things that we think about in terms of monitoring and mitigating secondary cerebral injury, really supporting cardiopulmonary function, thinking about detecting the underlying etiology, and then working to correct any physiologic derangements with a lot of these steps. So, my thanks to the three of you. My thanks to all of you for listening to this podcast. We love to continue to hear from you. After each podcast, we always get few of you writing in. Please do so with any questions, perspectives, follow-ups. And we'd love, frankly, to hear your suggestions on future topics that you'd like to hear on CCPEM. We'll go ahead and close this podcast out for now. Thanks so much for joining us here on CCPM. We will look forward to talking to you soon on our next podcast. Bye for now.